are short of one person for an in-person quorum, but if you wanted to go ahead and get started, and it'll start off as informational until you get an in-person quorum, and then we can have the action items taken up. Yes, you can go ahead and start.
Here we go. I would like to call to order the May 4th, 2022 Citizens Advisory Committee meeting. Staff, please call the roll so that we can establish quorum.
Ryan Rossi is absent. Michael Fitzpatrick.
Present.
James Garvin.
Here.
Mark Bruner.
Here.
Ramona Bean.
Here.
Paula Ryan is absent. James Bonfiglio.
Here.
Richard Vasilotti. And I believe he's joining us virtually, so we'll address him in a minute. Mark Forrest. Vijay Mishra. Here. Thank you. Francisco Paco Gill is absent. Myron Uman.
Here.
Terry Brown.
And here.
He's on virtually. Greg Fagan.
Here.
Jim Knight is absent. The cities of Belglade, Green Acres, Lake Worth Beach, Riviera Beach, and the Port of Palm Beach will be marked absent for the meeting. Albert Richwagen.
Here.
And Wen Deng is absent. And actually with Vijay, we do have a quorum in person, Mr. Chair, so we can move forward as is.
Staff, are there any modifications to the agenda?
Yes, sir. So we do have Terry Brown that is requesting virtual participation due to the lack of handicap parking at our office. And then we also have Richard Vasilotti, who is needed at home for childcare coverage. And they are both online.
CAC members, are there any objections to allowing these members to participate remotely? Seeing none, these members are approved to participate remotely. Margie, please note their attendance in the minutes.
Yes, sir.
Are there any changes to the minutes? If not, can I have a motion to adopt the minutes as presented?
So moved.
Second.
I have a motion by Mr. Bruner and a second by Mr. Garvin. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Motion passes. Instructions on how to provide public comments are included in the agenda. Staff, are there any general comments been received?
No, Mr. Chair.
At this time, I want to invite the CAC member comments on items not already on the agenda. For members participating remotely, please utilize the raise hand feature in the Zoom platform, and then remember to unmute your microphone once you are recognized.
I have one tent card up for Myron and none of the virtual attendees with a tent card.
Mr. Gavin? Oh, sorry, Mr. Uman.
Thank you. I have two comments. First is I'd like to just inform the group that an article in a technical journal that I read just came out about the implications of traffic safety messages for traffic safety. There's a large study in Texas and discovered that when the traffic safety messages were general, as opposed to specific, these are traffic safety messages on large electronic boards that you see all over the place. We have many of them here. When the messages say exit ahead is closed, no problem. But when the messages appear to be general safety messages like wear your seatbelts or X number of accidents yesterday in Texas, those messages tend to create more accidents. They studied the 10 kilometers upstream of those messages and 10 kilometers downstream of those messages. And the messages, and there's a large database too, increased the accident rate by 5.4%. And the larger the font, the greater the increase in accidents. And as you might imagine, the accident rate decreases as they went through that 10 kilometers. So most of the accidents are very close to the message boards. This is a pretty serious conclusion And I'm sure that they're going to do more work in this area, but it suggests that unless there's a real message like exit ahead is closed, those message boards ought to be blank. That's one one comment, just for information. The other is a question. Mr. Brown has been complaining about no handicap parking adjacent or close enough to the TPA offices to be convenient. And I'm wondering if the TPA is doing anything about that. It seems unconscionable that there should not be handicap parking convenient to this building.
So I can address it because I actually did talk to Andrew about this recently. Jason did reach out to the city of West Palm Beach, and he did get us information about parking and that you are with a handicap placard. It's 4 hours, right, Jason? You are able to park for 4 hours free on the on-street parking. However, we do recognize that on-street parking is a first come, first serve. So we will look into paying to have a meter bagged for Terry so he can attend the meetings and right in front of our office. That way it's easier accessibility. It is something we're going to look into, and then we can reach out to him about that.
I'm glad you're looking into it. Curb parking is okay if there's some way to getting up the curb.
Right.
Well, I would be very, this is Terry Brown. I would be very thankful of that, and I'll be happy to pay for the bag. They cover the meter.
Well, we'll look into that, and we'll touch base with Terry later this, probably next week, actually, because we have more meetings this week, but we'll touch base with him soon.
I'll go in halves with you, Terry.
Thank you, Mr. Uman and Mr. Brown. Mr. Vazalotti. Yeah.
Richard, hey. Oh, there you go.
Yeah, sorry. Actually, a couple of comments on before I was what I was going to ask about on Myron's comments there about the signs on the highways. I mean, think about the billboard signs that are all over the place. Those can be very distracting as well. I always get a good chuckle on there's a billboard. I'm trying to remember. I think it's on the turnpike somewhere on the way to Orlando, whether it's to or from. And it's an air conditioning billboard, and it says your wife is hot. And I always laugh at that. And yeah, the temperature because your air conditioning is broken is hot, but that is a really distracting billboard. And I still laugh at it every time I drive by. So yeah, these signs can be very distracting. As far as that handicap spot, that's unacceptable having to use a meter spot and put your handicap placard up. City needs to step up, get the handicap spots up that are appropriate for the area to serve our citizens. That's unexcusable. And then the other thing was, this was a question I asked Jason a few months ago. I believe the multimodal corridor study for the buses is coming to an end. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'll cover, there's a public meeting that I'll talk about in the liaison report that is open for participation that we're hosting here. And you're referring to the multimodal corridor study for Okeechobee and State Route 7?
That's correct. So I asked you a few months ago before, you know, one of the main complaints when the survey was done on the multimodal corridor study was traffic in the Okeechobee State Road 7 area. And if you remember, I had a pretty good beef about $77 million was the first build up to a $1.89 billion build from the mall to Rosemary Square. I just find that unbelievable to even be talking about it. But my question was, if traffic in the area was one of the biggest complaints of congestion, I asked about if somebody would research or look into if the State Road 7 extension was completed. That road, obviously, everybody knows about being held up by the city of West Palm. If that was completed, how would that relieve traffic heading east on Okeechobee Boulevard? I mean, common sense will tell you that it would definitely help, especially if that's one of the main complaints. See if there was any follow-up on that.
So I just want to make sure I understand the question. So when I research it, so sure. You want me to maybe.
Well, another main. I'll. You want me to say it again? Maybe I can work.
Yes, please.
Okay. So when this was being done, there was a survey that was put out, and one of the top three complaints about the Okeechobee State Road 7 area was traffic congestion. Do you remember that as one of the complaints?
Yes.
Okay. And so I believe that that was done as part of the study of this multimodal corridor with this very expensive bus study they're looking at. If when State Road 7 is completed, the extension, is there any idea of what kind of relief of traffic congestion east on Okeechobee Boulevard will be relieved? I can tell you it's going to be tremendous. Did I lose you for a second?
Oh, we're here.
Nope.
Okay, yeah, my computer just did something weird.
Good afternoon. This is Andrew Euler, Deputy Director of Program Development. In regards to specifically for the Okeechobee Boulevard study, our consultants who are handling this, they're using the 2045 model projections for that for traffic volumes. And State Road 7 is considered like an existing plus committed project. So it's in the traffic model already. So the results you see in the study should take that into account for volumes on the corridor. But we'll verify with our consultants to make sure that that's an accurate statement I'm giving you there. But we'll follow up with that. And then outside of that, you know, we went through a conversation a while back, you know, a year and a half ago, I think, to amend State Road 7 back into the long range transition plan. And the TPA worked with the consultants about having two model results, one with State Road 7 and one without. And we can go back and look at that and make sure we get the answer to your question about what that relief is like on Okeechobee versus for volumes with the extension and without.
Yes, that would be it. Thank you so much, Andrew. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Mishra.
Thanks. So this is the question I had asked Jason during our last meeting. I was trying to see if there is a way we can get some presentations from some of the lead design in terms of like Palm Beach County FDOT regarding how they incorporate resiliency and sustainability in the design of the projects. A unique presentation or a specific project they want to present, that's fine. But I would like to see if there is something we can hear from them as to how they're doing those two things. Those things are becoming much more critical from the design, not in the construction point of view, but from the design. So just some feedback on that.
Thank you. I'll reach out to FDOT and find out the best point person to schedule a presentation on resiliency and their project development and, you know, what they're doing to incorporate resiliency into their projects.
Seeing no more comments, I'd like to invite Matthew Coma, TPA Chief Financial Officer.
Albert, I'm sorry, really quick. We did skip over the liaison's report, so Jason will review that. It's okay.
Thank you. So just to go over the liaison report, first item here, we do have a new staff member, Valentina Fakus. She is our new planner one, and she's on our multimodal development team. And so she previously worked with Boca Raton and holds a bachelor's degree in urban and regional planning from FAU. And she also is pursuing her master's degree, which she'll be completing shortly, with a certificate in GIS, Geographical Information System, used for mapping. So please welcome Valentina as a new member of the TPA. Next is a new FDOT secretary. Governor DeSantis appointed Jared Perdue as the new FDOT secretary as of April 7th. And he served the FDOT for nearly 18 years and most recently came from the District 5 in the DOT. Also, May is National Bike Month. So that was established in 1956, and National Bike Month is a chance to encourage and showcase many of the benefits of bicycling. Next is the Okeechobee Boulevard and State Route 7 Multimodal Corridor Public Workshop. The TPA is hosting this particular event, and this is part of our corridor study. And we're holding the event on May 10th from 2 to 4 p.m. right here in this office. And if you'd like to get more information, you can go to palmbeachtpa.org/okee, O-K-E-E. There's also a public workshop for the state A1A from Linton Boulevard to Atlantic. It's a public meeting being hosted by DOT, and the project is specific to repaving, restriping, and safety and lighting improvements along A1A, and there will be an event that you can either attend virtually or in person on May 12th at 5 p.m., and this is in the city of Delray Beach, and this will be at their Swinton Operations Center, and that's located on Swinton Avenue in Delray Beach, and D4FDOT.com is where you would go, and that's District 4. That's what the D4 is, D4FDOT.com. And we're also hosting another event, the Vision Zero Workshop. This Vision Zero Workshop, it's an invitation to all of the local municipalities, and this will be held on May 13th from 2 to 4 p.m., and you can register for the event. This is a virtual event, so registration is at palmbeachtpa.org/VZ workshop, VZ for Vision Zero. Next, our governing board meeting will be held this month on Thursday, May 19th at 9 a.m., and you can participate either in person here at our office or live, and you can get more information about the TPA governing board meeting at palmbeachtpa.org/board. A few more here. There's a multimodal project discretionary grant, and this is from the USDOT, has a funding opportunity for three different grants. They have mega, infra, and rural, and the applications are due May 23rd. And you can find more information about these three grants at transportation.gov/grants. And lastly, the Palm Beach County Economic Summit on Housing and Transportation. This is a Palm Beach County hosted event, and this will be held June 2nd from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Palm Beach County Convention Center on Okeechobee Boulevard and here in West Palm Beach. And this event will be focused on housing and transportation, and you can get more information at our website, palmbeachtpa.org/PBC Economic Summit. And that concludes the liaison report.
Staff, are there any public comments on this item?
No, Mr. Rich.
Do any committee members have any comments or questions on the liaison report? Seeing none, I'd like to now invite Mr. Matthew Coma, TPA Chief Financial Officer, to present this item.
There we are. Good afternoon. I'm back with you today to present the final draft of our Unified Planning Work Program, or UPWP, for fiscal years 2023 and 2024. As a reminder, this document serves as our two-year operational plan and budget, so it will serve a period of July 1st, 2022 through June 30th of 2024. This also is our application for grant funding at the federal and state level. It includes our tasks, such as what will be accomplished, who will do that work, when those efforts will be completed, and how much it will cost to accomplish that work. There are seven core tasks to our UPWP: engage the public, plan the system in short range, plan the system in the long range, or LRTP, prioritize the funding, implement projects, collaborate with our valuable partners, and administer the agency is our final task. Now, from the version that is provided in backup to today's agenda, we received comments from FDOT and from FHWA. our funding partners, and we are still incorporating some of their comments into the document. For time constraints, we will have those requests and comments incorporated to what's taken to the board. What I'm going to highlight today are some of those changes that will be put into the document. We were, from the draft that came in March, we were notified of additional funding through the Federal Transit Administration, FTA, of an additional $167,000 in both fiscal 23 and 24. We've incorporated that into our budget, and we'll be using that within task two, which is our planning the system in short range. It was also requested that we clarify our FTA, or Federal Transit Administration funding, that's going to carry over. So we have some funds that we're spending now. We won't expend all of them. We're going to use those in fiscal 23, and we'll clarify that with some language within the document, exactly how that will roll over. There were some changes to the document itself that happen as we navigate this process. And the first one is the certifications and assurances that are required for federal funding, that those are usually completed after the initial draft. So we complete those, and then we embed them into the document. So that's been done. There's some additional execution dates for agreements that are associated with our UPWP. It was requested that we include the FDOT District 4 planning activities. So that's embedded within the document. We also need to embed integrate the federal planning emphasis areas. So that will be added before it's taken to the governing board on the 19th. And lastly, a request to update the table of contents, as we've added some additional documents in here for ease of navigation. There were some detailed clarifications that were requested of how are we going to use legal services. We have many important efforts, and legal consultation is required to do that. We have a legal team at this time. We'll be renewing our contract with them in June that will serve through the duration of the new UPWP. So beyond June of 2024, they'll still be in place. Also, it was requested that we define the software purchases that we would be doing. We have several specific software packages that we use to support planning, and such as GIS tools. And so it was requested that we clarify that within the document. So we will be doing that. As a federally funded agency, we have to document and receive authorization for purchases that exceed $5,000. This is specific to equipment that we might need to support the planning process. So we can include it within the document now, or we have to request specific authorization later. So we're working to incorporate that request as well. We were asked to clarify the total cost to do the TIP and the LRTP. That's our task three is the LRTP, and task four is the TIP. So we have identified that, and we'll clarify those comments with FDOT and FHWA. Lastly, was to document our efforts for the MPO functional classification and the boundary map. All MPOs are required to have that. So our agency will just document those efforts that will continue in the new budget cycle. There were some specific requests related to how we document our consultant efforts. And on the top, and the top version is the draft that we brought in March. You'll notice the blue language on the bottom is not there. They requested us to specify the magnitude or the budget for consultant support. So we'll be adding that within the tasks where consultants are supporting us as possible. In similar fashion, the version on the top was the March draft that was brought before you, where we specified the completion date is annually. We do it every year. And they requested that we do a month and date, so December of 2023 and December of 2024. So these are some small details, but we dot the I's and cross the T's to make sure that we're compliant and have everything in line for our approvals. They also requested some clarification of our public engagement efforts. and specifically public meetings and workshops that we hold. That was not included, or that language was not specifically called out in the draft. So we'll be adding that language for the final version that we take to the board. And as I mentioned earlier, we have some additional funding from FTA. We've incorporated that into the revenue that we can receive in expenses. And that's reflected that our budget in fiscal year 2023 is $5.1 million, and fiscal year 2024 will be $4.9 million. And then our expenditure categories break down into grant funded and locally funded activities. And again, the total budget for those expenditures will be $5.1 million in fiscal 23 and $4.9 million in fiscal 24. And where we stand in this process, the timeline, we have brought the draft in March. We've obtained the comments from FTA, FHWA, and FDOT. We're incorporating all of those. Today, we're bringing this before you, seeking a motion to recommend adoption by our board. And then the board will adopt on the 19th. And then it goes for final approval and execution of agreements before July 1st. So the budget goes live. And again, we're seeking a motion to recommend adoption of the fiscal year 2023-2024 UPWP.
Thank you very much. Staff, are there any public comments on this item?
No, Mr. Chair.
Do any committee members have any comments?
You do have quite a few tent cards up.
Go left to right, Mr. Uman.
Sorry. Total expenditures in FY24 will be less than FY23 by roughly $200,000 if it went by quickly. But can you explain why the total expenditures are going down?
Yes. So we have, with the passage of new legislation and available funding that's going to come to the TPA, just the time frame for all that to happen is going to front load in fiscal year 23. Essentially, those funds would be available right now to us to use, but because of all the mechanisms to make those funds available, it won't show up till a little later. So it makes it artificially inflates fiscal 23, and then it settles back to where it would be in 2024 going forward.
So there must be some level of effort that's higher in 23 than in 24 that requires more money. I mean, the fact that they're sending you more money is, I'd like to know what they're sending you more money for.
We are conducting additional corridor studies and additional efforts in 23 and making use of the funding that's available to us. So as mentioned, we're wrapping up the multimodal corridor study on Okeechobee Boulevard. There are additional studies planned in fiscal 23 and those efforts will be largely funded from that additional revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Uman. Ms. Mean.
Thank you, Matthew. I had a couple of questions, if that's okay. One was, and you may have already covered this, so forgive me for asking again, the public engagement part, what public engagement are you asking when you say you guys want to, like people reaching out and doing public comment with us here, or sending in something when you guys put something on the internet, like a survey, just in terms of your goals? I'm just.
Sure.
Thanks.
Bear with me, I'll get to the right slide.
It's okay, this is toward the beginning.
So we have seven different elements of public engagement. We track how many participants are viewing these meetings remotely, how many attend in person, how we reach them. There are surveys that are part of the LRTP that mm-hmm. takes place to see what people really want to see in their transportation system, as well as several other measures, and I don't have them in front of me now.
That's okay.
But they are.
Do you feel like it's backup. Do you feel it's increased recently or not? Like, would you say, like, just layman's with that data?
I would say yes.
Yes.
And I don't have the I don't have those numbers for me, but I can get them for you. But they have increased with our director of public involvement and specialists that are devoted to that effort so that we really reach the community, get their input. We want to know what the citizens of Palm Beach County have to say about the transportation network. Yeah. So again, okay. Public meetings that happen with part of the LRTP process and other events that are occurring. We're doing webinars in addition, as mentioned by Jason, that are upcoming, and other opportunities that we make available.
Okay. And then additionally, if I may, just one more question. The consultants fee, I see it's a lot of money, right? Like $750,000 was mentioned, and then we have budgeted. Again, this is me learning. Is it groups of consultants? Is it certain people? Is it certain whatever you guys need at the time? How is that?
Our consultant work breaks down. It depends on the contracts that we have active. We have two general planning consultants who we largely do outreach through them. And so they do a lot of support effort for us. In addition, the LRTP on its own, we have a consultant that's generally dedicated to just that effort because it's a critical document for our agency. We also work with some other agencies within the region. Treasure Coast Regional Planning Council serves as in that type of role in providing support for these surveys and public outreach. So okay. That's how we use them.
Thank you for explaining. Thanks.
If you'd like, yeah, you can share.
Sure. Hi, Melissa Murray, Public Relations Director. I just wanted to clarify a few things. There's, as Matthew mentioned, a lot of elements to public involvement. One of the big things that we do and that Valerie has been helping us with is doing a lot of presentations, webinars, panel events, things like that. Some of them are in person, some are virtual, some are hybrid, to really get the community involved as well as stakeholders who are interested in transportation planning to talk about ways that we can expand the transportation system, see what people are interested in. As far as the 561 plan, we're currently, I know Jason had mentioned the Okeechobee workshop that we're doing next week. The previous two parts of that study, we had done one in person and a online workshop. And then the second part, we had done a month-long online workshop and both of those included surveys to get feedback from the public about what we were what we were presenting, what they were interested in, things like that. And then public comments are part of that as well. We had a survey that people could fill out, and then there was also a comment map. So at the end of the survey, you could give your comments in that way.
Thank you so much. I'm also trying to understand how we can help you guys better. Like, I know we're supposed to represent regions of, but I figure I can post it on my social media and say, hey, fill this out. Sure. So if that's something we can do as well to help, without having to expend more money. I mean, it's something we can share with others and just see if we can get more people to pay attention to what you guys are doing. So
yeah, that would be great. We appreciate any assistance in getting information out. One of the best ways that we do that is through our newsletter. So if you're not subscribed to that already, we would recommend that you subscribe on our website, and you can always forward that to whoever might be interested. And then yes, of course, posting on social media is great as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Ramona. Mr. Fitzpatrick.
The municipalities I'm used to, they all have a one-year budget. How did the TPA end up with a two-year budget, and how's that working out? Is that more efficient or what?
The two-year budget cycle is part of the Unified Planning Work Program system, and it's been in place for many years. They authorize funding at the federal level on a two-year basis rather than annually. And it's largely to do with the funding source and how that's the effort required to establish the grants and put them in place versus a municipal budget, which would be rolling on taxes that are accumulated and collected. So I believe it's for efficiency that it's done on that two-year basis.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fitzpatrick. Mr. Terry Brown.
Terry, you'll need to unmute on your.
I got it. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Could you go back to the pie-shaped chart where the funding is?
there. My question is that the members are the red, right? That's the municipalities and the county?
Yes, that's correct.
Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So how is that determined? Is that determined by population or number of roads that go through your jurisdiction? Is it just based on the number of people in that particular? I mean, the county is the largest entity, right? So how does that get calculated?
That's calculated based on it's per capita. It's 10 cents per capita is what we collect as a member due to support these additional efforts.
So it doesn't have a sliding scale based on the projects in a particular area, just based on population changes.
Yes, that's correct. It's strictly based on population.
So when you divide that out, I mean, I know that there's some of the smaller municipalities are not included. How many are included? How many jurisdictions are included in that slice of the pie?
We include those who have a seat on the governing board. So those municipalities who have a seat on the governing board are those who are included for collecting the member dues.
Okay, so that's like 17, is it?
I think it's, if I'm calculating right, I think it's 15 because it's the 13 municipalities, the port, and the county.
So in the overall budget scheme, that's not a whole lot of money. Most of the money is coming from grants and funding, federal and state sources.
Yes, that is also correct.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much. I'm just interested in how that was done.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Do I have any member comments at this time?
I don't have any additional online comments, or I don't see any tent cards either.
I need a motion to recommend approval for the fiscal year 2023-2024 Unified Planning Work Program. Then I can open the floor for discussion.
I move.
Second.
I have a first from Mr. Mishara.
Second.
Second by Ms. Bean. Please call the roll.
This doesn't require a roll call vote. So if you want to do all in favor, all opposed, or if you'd rather roll call,
I can. All in favor say aye, opposed say nay.
Aye.
Motion carries. Thank you. I'd like to invite Mr. Jason Price to present this item.
All right, good afternoon, everyone. So today I'm going to present to you the first reading of the draft transportation improvement program. You'll see this item twice. This is the first reading of it. The second one will be the formal adoption the following month in June. And this particular document, the transportation improvement program, covers a five-year time horizon from 2023 to 2027. Now, as part of our mission, it is to collaboratively plan, prioritize, and fund the transportation system. And by way of the Transportation Improvement Program, this is a funding document that lists all of the funding for all of the projects that will be constructed and funded within that five-year time period. And through this TIP development process, you see we move through the process of selecting projects, prioritizing those projects, and through the TIP document, funding those projects. And the last time we met and we saw a snapshot of all of the projects, they came from the draft tentative work program produced by FDOT. That was the prioritized section of the process, and now we're into the funding section portion of our mission. And you see by the timeline at the bottom here, we're in the draft TIP timeline portion of the development and adoption of the TIP, and we'll see the final draft of this particular document next month in June. And once this is formally adopted, we'll begin to operate under this new document in the months following. Now, the TIP document is broken down by sections. You can see that in our table of contents. And within the executive summary as well, there's a number of summary tables. And so the first collection of projects that you'll see are the TPA priority projects. And there's three primary ones, the state road modifications, local initiatives grant program, and the other grant program is transportation alternatives. And that makes up the three TPA priority project categories or list. In addition to the TPA priorities, there's a good section for FDOT priority projects and other projects, and those are the mainline projects called CIS capacity, which is I-95 and the Turnpike. There's also other FDOT and local projects. I ask for all the local municipalities that have transportation projects to be submitted, and we incorporate that into the document to give a good snapshot of all of the type of transportation infrastructure that's being built throughout the county, in addition to our priorities and FDOT priorities. There's also other modes of transportation, airport, railroad, and seaport. And then with all of this infrastructure being built, it also has to be maintained. And there's a number of projects for operation and maintenance, for major maintenance and operation and maintenance of both roadways and transit. So if you look at the executive summary or the full document, the first tables that you'll come across are a collection of summary tables. And those summary tables give you a good overview of the list of projects by category or by section that the TIP is broken down into. And the first column that you'll see is the year and the priority or the ranking of those particular projects in those particular categories, like our two grant programs or state road modifications. In addition to that, when you go from left to right, you'll see that there's common years that are adopted in the TIP. And it's a five-year document. And so the common years are always the first 4 years. And each year that I bring back the draft TIP and approve the final TIP, what's happening is we're adding a new fifth year. So the farthest year out, which was fiscal year 27 in this case, is the newest year that's being added to this document. And that's how we kind of track the projects as they move through. You can track the projects as they move through the process by this new fifth year, always adding new funding and new projects added when they get funding in fiscal year 27 or whatever the fifth year is of this particular document. So, similar to last year, I ask that when you review the document, if you find to check out all of the project details, the summary tables, and overall, look for readability. And if you see corrections or something that is you have questions on, so please reach out to me. I create the document each year. I present it to you, but it's a lengthy document. There's a lot of different sections, and it's great to get feedback and get confirmation of the accuracy of the projects and what its contents are. And if there's any questions or feedback, or if you see any corrections or anything to highlight or make more clear. I actually got one from Myron for CEI, which is construction, engineering and inspection, which was not in the glossary, but it is a funding source or a funding code. It's a phase within projects that FDOT incorporates because they provide oversight to projects. And so I was able to incorporate that into the glossary and kind of define that term because it wasn't necessarily there, but it is something that is present in the document throughout a number of the projects. So thank you. And those are the kind of comments and feedback that I'm looking for in this particular document. So another kind of snapshot, similar to what you saw with the UPWP that Matthew presented, there's a good snapshot of how much funding is in this particular document and where is it kind of parsed out? What are the sections that attribute the almost $3.5 billion that the document provides in 5 years. You could see that CIS capacity or the main line, the trunks of the transportation system, main lines, or which is I-95 and Turnpike, make up the most of the funding and that you see in the document. And a lion's share of that is state funding, and a lot of that state funding is derived from the Turnpike, which has their own revenue generating source by being a toll road. So by them collecting their own revenues, they're able to implement their own fund their own projects. And so it's represented in the CIS capacity section. And so that's kind of how that breaks down as being the lion's share of the funding within the document. And you also see the local funding as another portion of it, where you see operation and maintenance for both roadways and transit has a considerable amount of local funding, because once it's built, there's more roadways on local networks, and also transit is funded locally. So this next section, I'm going to pass it over to my colleague, Connor Campobasso. He's going to go over a strategic intermodal system and the state road modifications.
Thank you, Jason, and good afternoon, everybody. Since the CIS takes up such a large portion of funding, we wanted to break it down for you a little bit, just to give you an idea of what's kind of going on in that pot of funding. And in addition to that, I'll also touch on the state road modification system as well. So in the CIS, like Jason mentioned, this is the high priority network for DOT. So it includes things like I-95, the Turnpike, and I think also State Road 80 is included in there as well. As well as Beeline Highway and roads like that. So this in the next 5 years, so in this this TIP, there's going to be about $1.5 billion allocated to the CIS network. And that's through a variety of different projects, things like turnpike widenings and interchanges. There's about $900 million in construction and design funds for interchange projects and turnpike widenings. There's also 11 I-95 interchanges that are going to be coming up for construction in the next 5 years. And that's about $400 million. And then I mentioned also Beeline Highway as well. There's going to be a widening project on there that's going to cost about $156 million. And on top of that, there's even more CIS projects going on throughout the network, which I'll show a map later on and give you an idea of what that kind of looks like. So breaking down the turnpike a little bit more. So there's a lot of funds going in there in total. Over $900 million are going into the turnpike in the next 5 years. These five projects here are some of the more major ones. So these are capacity projects. We have them listed from north to south on this slide here. So things like Okeechobee Boulevard to Beeline, Southern Boulevard to Okeechobee Boulevard. There's another project in 2024. So that's going to be the closest one coming up, and that's the West Palm Beach Service Plaza to Southern Boulevard. And then as we go to the southern part of the county, there's a project north of Glades Road to south of Atlantic Ave, as well as Broward County Line to Glades Road. So there's a lot going on the turnpike, but there's also a lot going on 95 as well. So there's 11 interchange projects that are coming up for construction in the next 5 years. So, or five plus years, I should say. So in 2023, we have Indiantown Road, Belvedere Road, as well as 6th Ave coming up for construction. In 25, Boynton Beach Boulevard. And then as we look further out, 2026, we have Northlake Boulevard and 45th Street. And 27, Palm Beach Lakes Boulevard, Hypoluxo Road, and Gateway Boulevard. I think it's important to look at the projects that are further out as well, because those are the projects that could potentially have a little bit more flexibility in the design. So if you have comments on these types of projects, those are the ones you really want to look at as they get through design and start entering in construction. These types of projects get a little bit more rigid since DOT's already gone through the design, public involvement, and things like that. So 2023, it's a little bit hard to make comments on, but those further out ones, those are really important to take a look at. And those are the ones that you can really provide good feedback on. So I didn't want to bring those up. So I talked about a map. This is all the CIS projects that are coming up in the next 5 years. You have roadways like Beeline Highway that have, yes, they have that capacity project that's coming in. That's $156 million, but they're also doing some traffic management systems, some connected vehicle improvements throughout the whole corridor in Palm Beach County, as well as some resurfacing projects on that road as well. And then you also have future projects. So Southern Boulevard, there's some PD&E funds coming up for that to study that interchange as well. And as we move to the southern part of the county, like I said, there's 11 interchange projects that are coming up for construction, but there's also other improvements on 95 that have been going under construction. There's still funds on those, things like the Glades Road interchange, which is under construction right now, as well as the I-95 widening in the southern part of the county. So there's a lot going on the CIS network. But in addition to the CIS network, we also have a lot of responsibilities influencing other state roads. So we have the state road modification program where we work collaboratively with DOT as well as our municipalities and the county to try to help improve, especially complete streets and safety improvements along state roadways. And this has been a great program. There's a lot of things coming out of it. We do have some updates on some of the projects, one of which is, as you all know, State Road 7. There's been some litigation going on with that. So that project's been delayed. So you may see some funds in, especially 2022, there's like some construction funds in there that will probably most likely be pushed back. So even though they're in there, it's probably gonna be delayed a little bit depending on how the litigation goes. It might show up in 2023, 2024, it really depends on how that goes. But I know Jason sent out some information on that. So unfortunately, that's all we know right now on that one. Atlantic Ave, again, another project we've been working closely with DOT on. There's been a little holdup with the water management district. We were hoping to get a little bit more right away from them, but we're still working through that. We're hopefully going to work some things out. We're going to meet with the water management district there and try to get that project moving forward. In some better news, we do have the State Road 80 project, which is moving along. That utilizes local initiative funding, but that's going to provide a lot of safety improvements along State Road 80. And that's going to be coming in two different phases. So there's some earlier years for lighting and then some later years, which is also going to include some lighting. So again, another project that we're working through. But in addition to that, we do have three new projects. So we have a project coming in Forest Hill Boulevard, as well as Congress Ave, and then some traffic signal upgrades in the city of Bo-Katan. That's going to be throughout the entire city there. But that's all I have for my presentation. So I'll pass it back over to Jason. Thank you.
Thank you, Connor. So now we'll transition into the two grant programs and also some of the FDOT projects that you'll see in the summary tables. The first of the two grant programs is local initiatives. That has a five-year target of about $100 million, so it averages out to be about $20 million a year that we offer annually through a competitive grant program that we administer here, along with the other grant program I'll cover in the next slide. And so through that program, we have, in this document, we've programmed seven projects funded for construction in fiscal year 26 and 27. And those are the projects on the left side here. And those have all been ranked and prioritized from year 2020 to 2021. So you see the year and the rank on the left-hand side and some of those particular projects for both Palm Tran and several of the municipalities that include Lake Worth, Wellington, Royal Palm Beach, Tri-Rail for new passenger rail trains, and also Palm Beach County for Prosperity Farms Road. Some of the upcoming projects that have moved successfully through the process and have, you know, been awarded back in 2017 and 2018 are now coming up for construction next year. And those are Delray Beach projects at Lindell Boulevard and Barwick Road, and also West Palm Beach and Parker Avenue. And occasionally we have projects that do get canceled. And one of those particular projects was Indian Town Road in Jupiter. And we, if you recall, that was one of the amendments to the currently, the TIP that we're currently operating under, where I brought it to you by way of an amendment to remove that project from the Transportation Improvement Program and take it off the list. The next program is the Transportation Alternatives Grant Program. That's the counterpart to local initiatives. It's a smaller pot of funds, so has a three-year time horizon of about $9.3 million. Within this five-year document has a three-year timeline. And so there's a shorter timeline. You kind of push through, you see a lot more projects, smaller in nature, but of great quality because they're bike and pedestrian focused. And so there's a list of projects here that were funded that we'll see go to construction next year in 2023. And, you know, these projects were prioritized and ranked in 2019 and 2020. And you see those as at the top of the list. And through the last cycle, grant cycle, you see fiscal year 25, these up and coming projects that were programmed, and they were kind of a backlog of projects that There was some delayed funding. And so those are all 2021 projects that were successfully programmed with funding. And those are at the last half of the screen here for 2021. And you can see Burns Road, El Rio Trail, Grapeview Boulevard, and the CA Canal. So there's a lot more projects that you see that go through this program. And they get successfully implemented, and they're all usually bike and pedestrian in nature. I have a few more slides, and that's just kind of giving you a snapshot of some of the up and coming construction projects that you'll see across the county, either by FDOT or Palm Beach County. And you see there's some capacity projects here that are coming up next year on Beeline Highway, Lyons Road, and 60th Street. As well, there's resurfacing projects and some bridge projects also in fiscal year 23, which is next year, on State Route 15, a bridge replacement project in US 1 over Earman River Bridge, and State Route 7 from Southern Boulevard to Okeechobee Boulevard. That's another resurfacing project. In addition to those types of those projects, there's new projects that we'll see that are new to the TIP document, and their FDOT initiatives, their types of projects that are being listed. And there's a longer list in the summary table, but this is just a snapshot of a few of those particular projects. And those include US 1, A1A, South Dixie Highway, Lake Worth Road, and Boynton Beach Boulevard, all listed in the summary table. So I encourage you to go there and kind of get familiar with the document and check it out, and definitely provide feedback if you need any, if you want any clarification or ask any questions on the document. And with that, this is an informational item, and I'll see you next month for a motion to adopt this when it becomes and takes its final form. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Jason. Staff, are there any public comments?
No public comments.
Do any committee members have any comments?
Starting
left to right, Mr. Yeah.
Garvin.
Yeah, Jason, real quickly, on the SRM tables, in particular 17.1, 18.1, and 19.1, you've called out areas for 561 planned transit corridor, new enhanced transit service with associated multimodal facilities across the table. As far as years and funding go, can you explain that real quick, or why that was done?
Sorry, are you asking if it's why it's split up like that? Or
yeah, so on the I'm looking at the TIP on the state road modification table, table one, on 17-1, 18-1, and 19-1, instead of data populating the cells across the table, there's just a blanket statement that says 561 planned transit corridor, new enhanced transit service with associated multimodal facilities. And that's cited three times in the tables. I'm kind of wondering why and what happens to the data for the rest that's going to be plugged into the rest of that tables, and when would that happen?
Yep. And the way we handle those, they're all sort of like a parent project. So for example, 17-1 is the US 1 from Camino Real Road to Indiantown Road. And as you mentioned, it talks about the 561 transit corridor description. And then a lot of times with these projects, there's different components of the projects that come into the as their own sort of project underneath that. So a lot of these might have, for example, a transit signal prioritization piece as its own project. And so you'll see that as a line under there. You might see enhanced transit shelters. That would be another line under there. If it's a major roadway reconstruction, that would be a line. So a lot of these are just being piecemealed for implementation as we sort of like phase these things forward.
Okay, so it's basically just designating an over an umbrella project.
Yep,
Gotcha. All right, cool, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Garvin. Moving around, Mr. Mishra.
Just curious, I think I know the answer, but is there a reason that we in your SIS, we don't talk about Sawgrass extension to I-95, it's because of the Broward MPO?
Yeah, I think, it's outside Palm Beach County. So this would only cover our footprint, which is Palm Beach County, and the Broward MPO would probably cover Broward County. So unless it crosses over and there's a shared expense. Do you have something?
Yeah. So the reason why it's not in RTIP is, the funding is completely localized in Broward County. If you are interested in that project, it is in DOT's work program. It's listed out, so all the funding is in there. But the reason why it's not in here is it's just not in our jurisdiction. So, yep.
Mishra and Mr. Terry Brown.
Yes, on the page where you have the funding for the Palmtran electric buses. Can you go back to that page where you, if we're 26, 27? Yeah, right there.
Yep.
That was ranked in the year 2020. You're saying that it's already funded. Is that going to be a lump sum that Palmtran is going to figure out how many buses they can get out of your lump sum? Or is it by bus? How did you do that?
So through the competitive grant program, they're eligible to apply for up to $5 million. And I believe in 2020, they asked for two buses, maybe four buses. They've applied a couple of four. Okay, so they applied for a total of four electric buses as part of their transition initiative to cleaner energy buses. And so they specifically apply for four buses that have a total amount. And then when we rank those projects and fund them, that funding is then converted or kind of flexed to FTA. So it doesn't kind of go through the same programming as a normal project where you would go through design and construction. It's just a capital expenditure of buying the buses in the year that the funding is available, which would be either 26 or 27. I have the tables here.
I know that the buses are expensive, but by the time they purchase them, the price could have dropped and there could have been more money for more buses. You're saying it's got to be capped at $5
million. That's the maximum amount that they could apply for, but I believe they contract out before they purchase these buses. They purchase buses. Excuse me?
It takes about 18 months to build a bus. And by the time you order it, get delivery. So I was just wondering how they calculated that.
Yeah, when we go through the vetting process for each one of these particular grants, we ask them to provide all of the documentation of what's included in the price of the bus. So they already know a general base model of how much it costs and all of the additional accessories that they need on the bus. So they have a really good idea of how much the bus is going to cost. And typically in my experience, they'll have a set price negotiated that would last several years so they can buy buses over a longer period of time that's already kind of pre-negotiated. So they don't, when it comes time to buy the bus, the price is always the same because they've already negotiated that price before actually committing to buying them.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Seeing no more comments, moving on to information item 3B, environmental research paper. I'd like to invite Mr. Michael Fitzpatrick to present this item.
Thank you. The question, as you see, is what being brought up is, should the TPA be more actively involved in helping the transition from internal combustion engines to plug-in vehicles? All right, it's not clicking. Do I have to do this one?
Yeah.
So clicking.
That'll take it. Okay, so it's all for the mouse.
Okay, just I want to press my finger isn't as strong as yours, I guess. Okay, so hopefully at the end of this, there'll be a motion to move this before the governing board at the June 16th meeting. All right, the problem is cars and pickups in Palm Beach County are spewing out 5 million tons of carbon dioxide into the skies of Palm Beach County per year. So that is a major portion that is approximately perhaps a little less than 20% of the total carbon dioxide is going into the skies of Palm Beach County, but that's the 20% that is due to part of transportation. So that's why we're bringing it up here. The problem with carbon dioxide, or one of them, is it's, you know, it retains heat or reflects heat rays back to the earth. But the main thing, it's a very stable molecule, so it'll be in the atmosphere, whatever we produce now, from 3 to 12 centuries, which means the stuff we've been putting in the last 100 years is still there, and so it keeps building up. And I'm trying to push it now because every month delayed is another 400 tons going into the skies of Palm Beach County. So is the solution is to help the ongoing transition from internal combustion engine to plug-in vehicles. Now that has started and it's not going to go away, and it's going to happen without our intervention. But I'm thinking with or without intervention, the difference is probably 4 years. So that would be another 20 million tons of CO2, which is, and we're pretty close to the tipping point. So we'd like to avoid that. The White House put out a position paper on in August of 2021, and it's like 5 pages to say this: 50% of all new passenger cars and light trucks sold in 2030 be zero emission vehicles. So does that goal, is it applicable to the TPA? Should, is that, so this is the legislation statutes for the TPA are part of it. And it says projects and strategies that will, and there's 7 categories. And out of these 7, 3 of them I think are applicable, and breaking them out just one by one. Number 2 is increased safety and security transportation for motorcycle vehicles. So we'll just, this is from a Tesla. And there's the bunny that doesn't get run over because the car can automatically move away. So if you can do that for a bunny, you can definitely do it for a human. So this would be a lot, it'll increase safety for pedestrians. This is another little quick thing here. So just driving down the road, nothing going on, and boom, somebody's got to pass and there's no room. So the car automatically moved out of the way and prevented an accident. This, is that the same? How do I get to the next slide? There we go. Okay. All right, this one I'm going to talk about later on too. So just going down the road in a snowstorm, boom, your car avoids an accident. And low visibility, going down an ice and you start to slide. Car automatically gets you back on track, no accident. And this one might even be from Florida. So the one to look at is, is up front. In the video, you can hear it peel out. So chain reaction. I think it's Florida. I can't see a license plate, but the trees kind of look that way. So here we go. Boom, boom, boom. And then the Tesla goes, not to me, and it peels out and avoids an accident all by itself. So that's one of the, so that's how switching over to electric vehicles can increase safety on the roads. Now, of course, number 4 was protect and enhance environment, promote energy conservation, and improve quality of life. So obviously protecting the environment is getting rid of, over time, 5 million tons of CO2 per year. Energy conservation is the average internal combustion engine
gets 22 miles per gallon. These are from a federal, you know, agency numbers, and it burns about 4.5 gallons per 100 miles. Now, converting the gas into BTUs into kilowatts, that's 160 kilowatt hours. So the average battery electric vehicle does 100 miles using only 34.6 kilowatt hours. That is 460% more efficient. So there we got some energy conservation. The other thing to point out here is that FPNL will sell you a kilowatt for about 11 cents. So there is some loss if you're charging it up at home. So let's say it costs you $4 to go 100 miles with an electric car. So that's less than a gallon. And improved quality of life. The American Lung Association has these figures for across the country. And, you know, how much of that applies to Palm Beach County alone, I don't know. But there's, you know, it is definitely a significant quality of life issue, breathing in gas fumes. Okay. This is the kind of what models all roads is. This determines how tight a curve you got, how much vegetation is cut back. And so this is how the basis, how long it takes to stop to drive safely and that sort of thing. So with electric vehicles, if you remember the one with the whiteout, now suppose all the cars on the road could communicate with each other. So even if you're 2 miles back, your car would know there's a car parked sideways in the road in the snow. And so all the cars, if they're communicating, would school together. You could have like a train connected electronically, and they would move around obstacles like schooling fish and keep going. So with electric cars are basically mobile computers. So you could perhaps double, triple, quadruple your safe capacity of a per lane without any extra infrastructure. This is just, where's this stuff carbon coming from? I'm gonna change the slide to show a lot more hydrocarbons, but, and then just use octane as example. So an octane, there's eight carbons in an octane. That's where the name octane comes from. So, whoops, that was twice. So basically, one molecule of octane uses 12 and a half molecules of oxygen to produce 8 molecules of carbon dioxide and 9 molecules of water. So as you can see with the little representation that the oxygen far outweighs the carbon dioxide. And so the molecular weight is 44, and that gives you a 3 times 0.7. So that's why. So gasoline is 87% carbon, and of a gallon of gasoline, 5.5 pounds is the carbon. So when you throw in the oxygen, which is using up, 1 gallon of gasoline produces 20 pounds of carbon dioxide. So if you average car drives 11,500 per year and 22 miles per gallon, that's 523 gallons of gasoline burned. And that is times 20 pounds is over 10,000 pounds, which is of course 5 tons. And then in Palm Beach County, this is from the state, I chopped it up, but I guess Palm Beach is a little too small, but that's over 1 million cars. So if you got over 1 million cars, then you're doing 5 million tons of CO2 per year. There, and when I was doing this, it appeared to me is it's not only the carbon dioxide that's going on, but it's using 5.25 million tons of oxygen. And nobody talks about that, but that's a lot of breathable oxygen that's disappearing every year and it's not going to be used again for 3 to 12 centuries. So I don't know if that's a problem, but that kind of bothered me. And it's also making a lot of water. Almost 2 million tons of water a year, which is also in the atmosphere of greenhouse gas. So the question is,
is it possible to get up to 50% new car sales by 2030? And the answer is yes, because it's already been done in Norway. On this graph, this is for what's happened historically in Norway. In 2011, they were close to zero. And then that's what I wanted to do. Oh, it's there. Oh, goody. So at 2018, right up there, you see it crosses the 50% line at 2018. And 2022, we're up to like 98% of all new cars sold in Norway at the beginning of this year are plug-ins, either battery or hybrids. So taking this graph and putting it onto a current timeline, so next year, you would see by 2030, it's the same time frame, it would be at 50%. And then in 2014, you'd be close to 100% of all new cars sold. Now that's just new cars. There would still be a lot of ICE vehicles still on the road. Now this is my guess. I'm assuming 20,000 new, the increase in registration of Palm Beach County, 20,000 per year from here to 2030. And the average age for cars is 12 years. So that means 8.5% are bought new each year to replace the ones that are taken off the road. So if you put in Norway's curve, this is how they increase each year. And then if you multiply them together to actually get a number, that would be like you'd be selling 1,500 new cars in 2023, then 3,000, 24, 25, 5.5. Till you get to 2030 and 50% of new cars will be close to, well, over 52,000. So if you put that, graph that, so this is the amount of cars on the road. And right now they're close to 100% being ICE. And then over time would decrease. Now at 2030, this line, I can't really, it's a bad graph, Mike. Professors at FAU would not like this graph because it's too small. It becomes straight line down. And so this is in 2042, the only cars that would be ICE on the road would be cherished antiques. Now, what we're requesting the governing board to do would be to kick it back to the technical advisory board to verify the data and the assumptions and report, and then come up with some ideas if they think it's a good idea to move it forward, and then bring it back to the governing board at a future time. And another thing to do is there's a lot of big transport. There's transportation. I have another graph in a second. And so there's more than just in transportation, obviously planes, trains. So you could look at other aspects too. And then if you want to really measure what you're doing, you need good metrics. So as you saw, there wasn't very good what the state puts out. It's useless as far as tracking what percentage of new cars are electric. This is what the government puts out, but here it says 2019, so it's old. But this is how many cars are sold nationally for each kind of car. And this is a screenshot, of course, but if you on the website, if you click on this, there's six lines of different kind of cars. And you see this jump from here to here in 1 year. That was the year Tesla came out with a new model. And this big chug here is the amount of new Teslas. And that's what jumped it up 100,000 plus. So this is on a different website, a nonprofit. Who knows if they're accurate, but they say Palm Beach County has right now 66% of new cars at Tesla, and then everything else falls in 33%. But it'd be nice to have an official agency to verify these kind of numbers. So then the other thing request would is for the TPA staff to assemble information that could be distributed to municipalities on to help them do fleet conversions. My understanding was last week, Boca had Boca city staff met with somebody to discuss moving ahead on their fleet conversion. So it's happening. All right, these are amount of greenhouse gas emissions by sector. And you can see the difference, how they break it all down over here. And then transportation is 29%. So if you just break out transportation, I think it says, can't see, 58% is light duty vehicles, which is autos and pickups. So these are the other things that at a later date could be considered, like aircraft, rail, ships and boats. But, you know, I don't know how much we'd be doing that, but that's all right. So that's what I think should be to start these little steps into checking it out. And that's what I'd like to bring before the governing board on June 16th. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Fitzpatrick. Before we have committee discussion, staff, are there any public comments on this item?
No, Mr. Chair.
I'd like to open up the mic to any committee members with any comments.
Yes, just an observation, something that I was made aware of just before I came to this meeting by somebody. I haven't independently confirmed it, but it's my understanding that Mercedes is projecting they may come out with an all-electric Sprinter van as soon as next year.
Yes, that's now I said autos and pickups, but another part of that is delivery vans, like all those Amazons come around, and GM and Ford are jumping all over that. That'll be real soon. That's probably because delivery vans, they do a kind of a set route. They come back to the same place every night. They know how many miles you're going to go to. That is probably going to go electric faster than anything else without government assistance.
Mr. Mishra.
Yeah, the biggest concern I had with the presentation was it sounded more like an ad for Tesla than actually comparison between.
Say that again.
The presentation sounded more like ad for Tesla versus the actual comparison of electric versus the internal combustion, because a lot of the features that are in the electric car can be on the safety wise. Most of that you talked about, they can be in the IC. So I think if we trim it down to only comparison of actual the carbon footprint and those kind of things that are more realistic than a lot of these things that are like special feature of Tesla, I don't think that should be the priority of the board. And the other thing is the when we are thinking about the new vehicle, yes, if you're buying it, yes, definitely we should be looking into more. But we also have to think about that the source of energy that is actually charging those cars has to be also a renewable source. We cannot just keep saying we need more electric car. The source of charging that we have to have also have to have this vision to say we need to make sure the most of the energy generation has to come from there. Then this makes a lot more sense that we want to push this. But without some of these guardrails, just pushing for let's get more electric cars, well, might not be a vision that we want to look into. Just my thoughts.
All right. Well, I can answer both those questions. First one, why aren't these in ICE cars? And they are in a couple, perhaps. I don't remember which one. Mercedes, Audi, BMW, Porsche, something like that does have a similar package for some of its cars. It's not going to be in any other ICE car. And the reason is, think about the shortage of chips. Cars weren't able to produce. Cars came back. It's like, oh, we need more cars. And it's like, we can't produce any more cars. We ran out of chips. Well, there was one. I'm not a Tesla fanboy, believe me. I'm not trying to buy a Tesla. But there was one car company that kept producing in the last year, and that was Tesla. And the reason was, is because they had more advanced chips. So when they ran out of chips, it'd be like looking around the factory floor like, well, we got a bin set of these chips. Can we use these? And like, yeah, they're a little more expensive. We won't use all the pins involved. But yes, we can reprogram and we can keep pushing cars out the door. Chevy, Dodge, Ford, we're not able to do that. And the reason is because the chips they're using in their cars are 20 years old. They're like two or three generations back on the evolution of chips. So there's like only one factory left in the world that'll produce these old chips, and they're only producing them for the companies. And they said, well, we need more chips. And the guy says, well, we're manufacturing 24/7. We can't produce anymore. We'll open up a new factory. It's like, well, that'll be X hundred millions, billions dollars. And it's only going to be good for till the chips are done in 18 months where you're caught up, and then nobody will use it because it's obsolete. And the reason they don't want to move anymore, because that'll cost their profit margin. So there is not going to be any more development. They've already stopped. If you look at some of the producing any more research into internal combustion engines, I read one article why this guy was very sad, because they're coming out with some new ideas, but they're just not going to be produced. So there's no more research in Ford and Chevy on internal combustion engines. So they're not going to dress up an internal combustion engine car with radar and three or four, 10 cameras on them and a computer. It's just, there's a limited lifespan on them, so they'll never get their profit back. So there's not going to be on any other cars. Now, as far as, yes, this is an old thing that's been going on a long time, is, oh, well, it doesn't matter. All you're doing, it's in my report, by the way, you're just shifting the cost of pollution. And so it won't be as polluted in Palm Beach County, but wherever that coal-fired plant is that's producing electricity, that'll still be the dirty air, will still be there. It'll still be pushing carbon in the air. Well, if you look at what's going on with energy production, in the year 2021, 87% of the production of power plants that went out of line were decommissioned, 87% were coal, and I think some oil fire. So that is the energy produced by FP&L. They are, look at their advertisements. They're really happy that they're producing more and more megawatts of clean energy. So the energy that's coming out of your outlet is getting lighter and lighter shades of gray. But not only that, the best way to do it is what I'm doing on my house. I have 14 solar panels. So when I get an electric car, I'm going to plug it in at night, and it's going to go straight from the roof or the battery into the car. It's going to be clean the whole way. And FP&L doesn't want you to realize that. But if you have solar panels, because it cuts down on their profit. But if you have solar panels, the reason we're still used is dirty power is because the politicians don't want to make FP&L be more efficient. Next question.
Okay, moving on. Thank you, Misha. Mr. Garvin.
Just to continue on what Vijay was saying, there is a separation between autonomous and safety features and electric propulsion. There it is. I drive an electric car. It's dumb. It's no different, no better safe features than a standard compact. Some of the autonomous tech that you're talking about that would improve safety features are definitely worth advocating for. But however, I think they're a decade plus from being in every car, new car sold. I also just want to say too that I appreciate your passion for this. I believe these are conversations that need to be had. So I appreciate this and your time and your effort. And I really do. But the safety aspect of this, I don't think is there. Okay. And I do hear what you're saying, that in the future, as electrification becomes prevalent, and I do understand the R&D issues, I've read similar things, it will have its place and its time, and those become more standard and will inevitably be safer. However, though, you do bring up a valid point about what is there that an organization like this could do to be talking about this movement from combustion to electrification and the infrastructure that goes with it, and all that stuff. So there is a valid question there as far as what needs to be talked about. But then I also say, what does this organization have the ability to do? What is within our jurisdiction? What is within the laws that govern this? You know, I know I cannot cite the exact ordinance, but I know there was a law passed by the state that basically says that municipalities cannot favor one type of vehicle infrastructure over another when it comes to planning and zoning and building permits, okay? So the question then becomes, what are the limitations of what can be done by the TPA to promote electrification amongst the general population of consumers? Granted, though, that's negligible because the options are going to be decreasing over time. As we all know, newer cars are being made with electrification. then there also becomes the next question of, okay, well, then what can we do in partnership with municipalities to, like I said, improve their fleet, improve their charging infrastructure, make sure it's there? What could that be done? That's not a question I think this board can answer, but it's a valid question. Okay. So I think part of what you're saying is great. And I appreciate your time and your effort on this. And because it is a discussion worth having, but they're also, your questions create more questions. And I think that that's above my pay grade to answer and most people that sit on this board, but are they questions worth being promoted? Yes. So the question then becomes, what do we ask of the staff and of other aspects of the TPA as far as investigating what is within the jurisdiction of this organization? And I don't know that. And that would be a course of action I think might be appropriate. But once again, I'm just one person on this advisory board. That's my thoughts. And that's it. Thank you.
Well, can I answer that? So as you saw, I listed there's seven different categories that the TPAs and MPOs are supposed to concentrate in. And to me, I look like three of the seven had aspects that were applicable to this. Now, even if you cut out safety, it's still applicable to do something about this for the number four environmental. So, and that's what I'm saying. It was multiple ways that this fits, I believe, the direction that MPOs are supposed to function. As far as who should decide, I agree. This is basically one person's opinion, but that's why the first thing was to have the governing board kick it back to the tech board and look it over. And they do have, I believe they have the expertise to figure out what should be done. But they need to be told that the governing board needs to be there to say, hey, yeah, we're kind of interested in this. Look into it, because they're not going to look into it unless they're instructed to.
And I agree. And I think, but like I said, we need to be careful on what we're asking and make sure that what we are asking, if there is a question put forth by this board, that what we're asking is something that is within the scope and the possibilities. Otherwise, we're just wasting people's time.
Right.
And I don't want to do that. And nobody on this board wants to send anybody on a goose chase. But I, like I said, you've brought a valid question though, of what could this organization do to move the needle on this issue. So that being said, you know, we can go from there.
I try to write those what we're asking, the actions we're asking the governing board to do. There was no real commitment to actually adopting it. It's like, look into it for these ways, like get a baseline, exactly how many electric cars are in Palm Beach County. Who knows? That's not a committing you directly to doing anything about it, but it is saying, let's find out where we stand. So that's basically what I think the thrust should be, is not asking them to do anything, to actually adopt anything, but to research it.
Thank you, Mr. Garvin. Thank you, Mr. Fitzpatrick. And Mr. Uman.
Thank you. I too am sympathetic with the issue. And I do have concerns about what the role of the TPA is. And TPA is in the business of infrastructure planning. And there are circumstances under which the TPA looks forward in its infrastructure planning beyond the five-year TIF. We have in the past talked about planning for sea level rise. The Broward, we had a presentation that indicated that the Broward MPO is looking at that, and Miami-Dade as well. It seems to me not unreasonable for the TPA to be planning for a transition toward electric-powered vehicles. And one of those issues, it seems to me, is charging stations. I wonder if the TPA staff has data on the number of and location of charging stations or what plans are for providing a greater network of charging stations. That seems to be a practical thing that in terms of planning the TPA could undertake.
I agree.
Thank you, Ms. Newman. Ms. Bean.
Michael, thank you again. I also echo my colleagues as well as James Garvin's comments. So I don't want to repeat them again. I just thank you for all the work you've done, and as well as the TPA staff in supporting you. Perhaps I'm interpreting that you're asking we task the other boards with pulling data on the usage right now of EV vehicles. Is that, am I hearing that correctly?
Well,
that actually, may be even how I processed it. So
I don't think this board has authority to task another board to do it. The only ones that would have the authority is the governing board. So we're asking the governing board to exercise their authority. But we are not directly asking anybody.
So we are proposing them basically an initiative to task the technical board with this.
We're the advisory board. So it's basically, the way I see it is the advisory board is going to the governing board and saying, hey, we're advising you, this is a problem. Can you look into it more, in a nutshell?
Okay.
We're not asked, there's nothing in it that's asking the governing board to make a decision now. It's like, can you please gather the data to see if you want to do anything about this sometime in the future?
Okay. Thank you for clarifying. And Myron, I like your idea too. It would be helpful with charging stations.
There is somewhere in one of the appendixes, I did try to look into that, and I couldn't find a good answer. I think I found the biggest one in Palm Beach County, which is at the Turnpike Lake Worth service area. But how many are in there? There's multiple networks, and it's very difficult. And Boynton Beach has some, Boca has some, but I didn't see any one ring that binds them all kind of data.
Being an electric car owner, I can assure you that most electrification and charging infrastructure in the county is based off the choice of municipalities and how they spend their funding and or developers feeling generous with their parking allotments. Basically, that's it. There's no uniformity countywide to it.
Thank you, Ms. Bean. My comment is to Mr. Fitzpatrick's presentation is 5 years ago, even talking about bike lanes and zero, net zero were so far-fetched for this board. And now look, it's our main motto. So I don't think that what you're presenting is such a far reach. I know Delray has a lot of charging stations. The Seagate Hotel put in multiple stations. They put them in all the parking garages on City Hall property. So I think it's something definitely to entertain and to see where it goes. I mean, it's definitely worth talking about. And if I was to project 5 years from now, we'll look back at this and say, wow, Mr. Fitzpatrick was a genius.
Tell my wife, please.
Albert, you do have two other tech.
Oh, sorry. Mr. Montiglio, thank you.
Yes. On charging stations, if you drive an electric vehicle when you purchase it, you usually get information from the dealership on where? Companies that will give you access to their charging station. You get a map of the county with charging stations. It's actually a national network, and they'll tell you where the nearest charging station is. You get a map of all these little dots all over the place where charging stations are. There's one that I own a car, and that's what I got. So I own an electric car. So anyways, I'm not really sure what you want us to do going through this executive summary. If you're asking us to send this executive summary to the technical advisory committee for them to act on it, I'm not sure they're going to be able to do anything with it, because I mean, I see that you attributed sources in the front page to several different people, but you have no attribution for any of your statements.
The full report is 78 pages, and staff decided only to put 5% in because they didn't want a long document.
Okay.
So there was a follow-up email that had the full 78 pages.
But does whatever your 2 pages or 78 pages have attribute your statements of fact to a particular citation that supports that? For example, you say there are over 1 million light duty vehicles registered in Palm Beach County. Where do you get that number?
State of Florida, and that was one of the, that was.
Is that cited though in your 78 pages so somebody yes. can look?
Yes.
The next line says each year the heat and pressure of ice piston chambers renders 5.25 million tons. Is there a citation to that information?
Well, so I just walked you through the math on that, chemical math on that, yes.
Thank you for the math instruction, but is there a document that's published by a verifiable agency?
Yes. If you remember the little diagram that had three, that was straight from Department of Transportation.
But is that attributed in your 78 pages?
I had up to like five footnotes per page. So yes, every statement in there has a backup.
Okay. Well, you know as well as I do that no governmental agency is going to act on this two-page summary.
Well, that's
because there's no attribution.
I was a little irritated that the full 78 pages did not get included.
Okay. And you know, I sympathize with you know need for electric vehicles. I've driven a Prius 5 years earlier, and then I bought a BMW electric vehicle 3 years ago. So I've driven electric vehicles for 8 years, and I appreciate the need, but. Again, I'm not sure we can be an advertiser for electric vehicles rather instead of somebody that will recommend it, facilitating what is probably going to be the dynamic trend for the next several years, which is a switch over from internal combustion to electric vehicles. And I share your concern about the being a Tesla advertisement, Commissioner Mishra. So. I'm not sure what you want us to do.
I want to say you looked at it, and which I'm very disappointed you weren't able to look at the other 74 pages, which is complete, documented at every statement in there.
But
ask Jason. He's read it.
All right. At the end of this, you want a motion to what?
This board recommends the governing board have the tech board research this issue and come back with some recommendations.
I thought that's what you were doing.
I'm just one person. This board, we don't have the expertise to really, nobody's going to listen to us. I have a civil engineering degree, but that doesn't have the right credentials. We needed to get it to the board that has the right credentials.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Von Figlio. Mr. Bruner.
Yeah, if I may, to sort of bring that together, I've been trying to summarize it in my own mind, and there are fundamentally two questions that are being asked. The first one is whether or not this board is a Citizens Advisory Committee and ultimately the TPA should make some kind of affirmative statement or some kind of affirmation on their part that they should support the replacement of combustion vehicles with electric vehicles. Sort of intuitively, that whether or not is, yeah. You know, so that's sort of the first question is whether or not. The second question, which is a little more complicated, is how? What does the TPA do and what can the TPA do within their jurisdiction to take more than just a lip service statement that we support the replacement of ICE vehicles with electric vehicles. And I appreciate you thinking that it should go to the TAC, but ultimately it may be that if we believe that taking that action, the weather is that we should say, yes, we think that the TPA should look into how it can support the replacement of ICE vehicles with electric vehicles, then the how is to either go directly to the TAC or to have the staff evaluate how the TPA can promote conversion to electric vehicles. And then the staff goes to the board and says, this is how you could proceed. There's policy and management having been on that side of the table, there's policy and management. And what we're essentially doing is going to, as the CAC, going to the board and saying, as a policy, you should do this in terms of promotion of electric vehicles. Then the how becomes, how does the TPA manage that? And that is when the TPA board goes to probably staff first and then ultimately the TAC and goes, how do we do this? How do we actually promote or support or encourage this effort? So there's really two aspects to it. Again, the first one I think is almost intuitively obvious. I think everybody here would think that we should probably support that conversion to electric vehicles. The second part, the how, probably, again, if the board agrees with us, say, I'm assuming today we would support electrification of vehicles. So we would essentially support the concept that he's putting forward. So the policy, yes, we go forward. The second part, the how, I think is the implementation part of it, of how does the TPA directly get involved with supporting that process is something that has to kind of go through staff to investigate how within the existing management of TPA and the management structure of TPA and the constraints on TPA, how can they actually move something forward to accomplish that policy goal? That's, in my mind, that's what I see the situation being.
Real quickly.
Gavin.
So, Mark, I think there is a two-part to this, right? There is a question one, which is a blanket statement to the board, which would be, is this within our realm of influence? Is this in our jurisdiction? Is this something that's, would this be scope creep or moving beyond what the TPA is supposed to do? Question one. Question two would then be, what can we do about assisting in this electrification, right? That would be probably the governing board would then have to ask the staff to devote staff resources to it to do so, hire a consultant or allocate the funding to do so, staff time, whatever. So that's all I think we could do. So it is basically just a two-part question, right? Is this within our jurisdiction? And then would you, as a governing board, say, yeah, it's within our jurisdiction. We think it's a good idea to look at it. That's really all, as an advisory board, we can do. I don't think, while it could go through the TAC for feedback, it's not going to, nothing's going to originate with the TAC, right? So I think that, you know, so that's kind of where I'm at. Like I said, it's a two-part question here.
Fagan?
Hi.
And just one second. And I have to either go add time to my meter in four minutes or yeah, we have to keep moving.
Me too.
Okay, sorry.
Just trying to stay on point of what our mission is. We're an advisory committee to the Transportation Planning Agency. The electric car or the electrification is just a component of a transportation system. I don't believe we're supposed to go into the type of car or the power of that particular vehicle, but we can make a recommendation that there should be an electrification component to the overall transportation plan, whether it's charging stations, et cetera, as we go through this transition. It is a fact, I have a family member that's a employee of General Motors, that they're converting entirely to electric vehicles. They aren't gonna make the gas engines anymore. The person is in the architectural components of the vehicle. It takes 10 years to develop all the architectural components of a car, amortize them out before you can even produce it. There are a lot less parts in an electric car than there is an internal combustion engine, and it means there's a lot less employees. You get rid of all the internal combustion engineers, etc. The cars are much simpler. They're all going to go electric. So if we're a transportation planning agency, then we shouldn't be promoting one car over another. What we should be doing is promoting the component of the infrastructure that can accommodate those. If that is charging stations, pull off areas, if the cars are getting smart, then the communication and telecommunication systems on the roads are going to have to get smart also. We were talking earlier about accident ahead and how it can actually cause more accidents. But if the cars ultimately are gonna be communicating with the infrastructure,
Yeah, cars are going pretty much autonomous. So I think we need to stay in our zone and just say that we're supporting a component for the accommodation of electric vehicles, whatever that is, whether it's charging stations in public facilities, additional ones on the road. I don't think we want to cross over into what are gas stations going to do? Are they going to go electric stations? We don't know. We got to stay in our zone. And that is, should there be, the question is, should there be an electrification component in our transportation plan, period, and ask the board to just look into it as a suggestion, as an advisory committee. That would be my recommendation. Thanks.
Maybe before we go further and continue the conversation, I wanted to offer a couple of options, and that is maybe taking a 5-minute pay your meter break and come back. So we're all good. Or we could adjourn and pick it up and table the next two items, but I don't feel like we're done here with this particular one. So the option of just taking 5 minutes to take care of some meters, is that acceptable with all of you? I don't want to just nip it and not have get to a final conclusion here, but
I'm trying.
Thank you, Michael. That was a lot of work and a great presentation. And I'm sorry that you didn't get to put it all in.
Well, I just want to say that Greg, I think, summed up a lot of good points. And I just want to say, I'm not a fanboy of Tesla. It's just, if you want to find interesting things on the internet, Tesla's got more than anybody else. So it's the lowest hanging fruit if you want to see cool stuff.
So do we decide on going through the next couple of items and coming back, or we just table those and bring them to the next?
Right. So
is everybody okay with that and coming back?
Either way, do we want to table the last two informational items? Yes.
Let's take a break and come back. We got snacks right next door for those at 5 minutes.
Okay.
I appreciate your guys' time. We do have coffee and snacks in the next room. Bathroom is right through that door.
Mr. Vice Chair, I just want to note for the committee, we did lose our in-person quorum. So there's no action items that the committee can take, but the rest of the items are informational only.
Okay, back to where we were. Is there anything technically I need to say?
No, you can call the meeting back to order.
The meeting is back in order.
I'd like to make a comment to answer some of the questions that was raised. In March, we voted for the Palm Beach Transportation Planning, 2022 legislative and policy positions. And if you read that over, number 1D that we collectively supported was mandate adaptive cruise control, lane assistance, and collision avoidance systems on new vehicle. So then, and another one was, let's see. Where is it? Well, all right. Well, I think that's enough. I mean, that clearly states most of those pictures we were talking about that seemed to get a lot of interest. That was all adaptive cruise control, lane assistance, and collision avoidance. So this board already passed in March their approval of that kind of work being done by the TPA. So I would hope that would continue over in this coming vote.
I'm thinking of how to move forward with what Michael has done, and I believe since we've lost a quorum, we can't really make a motion. But my suggestion, if you were to ask me what a motion should be, it would be that the Citizens Advisory Committee transmit this to the board. Have Michael transmit this to the board. The board receives and files a report. It's in the records. It's there, and direct staff to review the report and to come back with suggestions, recommendations, or identification of where electrification of vehicles and electric vehicles and the transition we're speaking of fits within the existing scope and responsibilities of the TPA and what can be done. That way they have the report, and as Albert pointed out, in a few years they're going to be looking at it and going, boy, this, yeah. That's exactly what we should have been talking about. But again, to go back to what Greg's talking about and what James has spoken about is staff can look at that report, look at what the existing scope and responsibilities and tasks are that the TPA is doing, then go to the board and say, okay, you know, these are the things that Michael has raised. These are the items in our scope of responsibilities that we can use to address those. And then the board can decide, you know, how within that scope they can do those things. And that would be the kind of thing, that's the way I can kind of see this would move forward.
To continue on with that, Mark, I think that the prudent thing, since we've lost an in-person quorum, there's no motions can be made today, right? We know that. So I think perhaps the best course of action is to figure out the simplest course of action. And that being said, we're basically saying a letter, a request sent to the governing board saying, is electrification infrastructure in regards to transportation within our jurisdiction, is that something we can coordinate with, right? Is it, period, just is it? If they say no, question two is pointless, no point. The second question would then be, okay, well then would you allocate staff time or resources to pursuing how this might impact Palm Beach County in our long-term planning and TIP and XYZ, however the verbiage needs to be worked out. But that's really all we can do. I don't think we need to, while I appreciate the 70 plus pages, I don't think that needs to be transmitted. I think the request is just very simple. We, as an advisory board, value this topic and we think it's something you need to look into. And that's it. They're going to take it or leave it. 70 pages or not, like you brought to our attention, you're getting a valid response that this is something we all are concerned about and something, if we have the jurisdiction to do, should be something to put forward. But the amount that's put forward, you know, you verge on, cool, we can put a consultant or a little bit of staff into it, or we can make it a whole strategic imperative, you know, like it could be go any direction. That's not for us to decide. But what we can do is, like I said, we can put a simple two-question request. And I think, you know, next month we have that verbiage figured out, what that request is, and then forward it. And then we vote on it, then forward it. I think that's all we can do at this point.
Seeing no more comments.
I will note one item. So because we did lose the in-person quorum, which we need in order for you all to take an action, even with your virtual attendees, we can bring this back as an action item on your next agenda so you can formalize the next step, and that you'll have a quorum hopefully present at that time. So you can formalize it, next step, what it's going to be, if anything, and then it'll close out this item.
So you'll add it to next month's agenda?
Yes.
I think that's great. Gives us all a month to kind of think about it, figure out what verbiage we think might be appropriate, and then hash it out and be done.
Can staff put the full 78 pages in next month's agenda?
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Fitzpatrick. Thank you, everyone, for your comments. Moving along, we have a non-action item, fiscal year 2022 strategic plan action 6.B follow-up. Mr. Jason Price to present this item. That's what it says.
Yep, I'll do it. Right. Jason worked hard on the tip this week, so I'll cover this presentation for them. So this covers a strategic action plan item that we had for this past fiscal year. Was to modify TPA committees to support TPA initiatives. And so it's an outcome of revising operating procedures if it's needed. We have three main committees, our technical advisory committee, the citizen advisory committee, and then now our changed committee to the Vision Zero Advisory Committee. So one of the outcomes of this strategic item was to expand or really focus more of our attention for that Vision Zero, our pedestrian bicycle and trailway committee to be more well-rounded with safety, and to also add law enforcement and firefighters on that board, that committee. So that role sort of expanded for that specific committee. When it came to the citizens advisory committee, we've had discussions, you know, off and on. It's not always with this these members, but over the few years, about some things, about ways maybe we could improve some of our operating procedures here. And so that's what really we were trying to focus on with the citizens advisory committee. So our current role and functions, and this is what's outlined in the operating procedures right now, is your role and function is to review transportation plans. So we have our transportation improvement program, our long range transportation plan, other corridor studies that come up throughout the years, and then also to have concerns of various segments of the community represented. Right now, our membership structure is one representative per governing board member, right? So that's for every governing board member we have one representative per each. Right now we have five vacancies. That's actually right now, I think we have three going through.
Two
going through. So we'll only have three vacancies after that. But we're still looking to fill those, and we're reaching out to those board members to get those filled. Based on statutes, governing board is required to ensure representation of minorities, elderly, and persons with disabilities. And I'll touch on that in the next slide. And then a few years ago, about 5 or 6 years ago, it was incorporated into the operating procedures to also consider representation from other types of community members: environmental, business, construction, development, freight and goods, private transportation, and general public. So that's our current operating procedures. Sort of how we meet these federal and state requirements when it comes to representation. I know this is something that gets brought up often at the Citizens Advisory Committee, but we do a survey of you all to track sort of our census of that for those demographic and social indicators that you've probably all filled out. As it stands right now, from the numbers I looked at the other day, we have 4 minority, 7 elderly, and 1 person with disability. This is all self-identified from you all. And then the way we sort of carry out that focus is to ask governing board members specifically in their requests when they're trying to appoint people to really consider these groups of people. So really consider minorities, elderly, and persons with disabilities. along with other ones that we've mentioned on the previous screen for different types of communities. And I wanted to point out, this is the most common process for an MPO to meet requirements. Other places in the state or in the country may operate differently. For example, our partner right here to the south, our neighbor Broward, they actually set theirs up where they have elected official appointments. Then they also have additional appointments for different social groups in the community, such as NAACP, AARP, and some other members of the community. And so that's sort of how they meet that requirement as well. But we are right now the most common process. This is how Miami-Dade operates. MetroPlan, Orlando also operates the same way we do. North Florida. And so, you know, we had these discussions in these past few meetings about potentially offering other types of setups for how we are structured here. But I know that wasn't really, you know, going anywhere with that. It was really just to sort of like get the discussion going and what you all thought. You all asked us to do a survey to send out, and we had 13 of 17 complete that and responded. And here we have in the backup, but also on the screen, just a summary of sort of what we saw as staff in that survey. Obviously, we're paraphrasing a lot of this, but overall, members said that representation of various municipalities is positive for the committee, that you enjoy the ability to share knowledge and best practices among communities. One note that there's a few that noted that communities without a TPA board member are not represented. So if you think about like smaller communities along the coast or ones out like, for example, Haverhill or smaller ones, Hypoluxo, you know, those type of communities are not represented. You also mentioned that you need to prioritize vacancies and expand recruitment. And then for the TPA board to be more mindful of appointments. We brought up those summaries of sort of what you provided yesterday or executive committee, just to get some of their feedback and just a general discussion as an informational item about any changes they might want to see or considering. They didn't really recommend anything outside of what you all said. One thing they did bring up was the time of your meeting right now. And we'd love your feedback on that too, if you want to. It's really an open discussion on this point. But one of the members mentioned that it can be hard to fill seats for citizens sometimes when it's during working days, during working hours. So trying to maybe push that meeting time back a little bit. So that was just one of the ones that they brought up yesterday. And just for everyone's backup, this is the executive committee is made up of 5 members of our board. So it's not the full board. It's just 5 members that met yesterday. So really that's all I had for you. We don't have any major changes to the structure that we have brought up or going to the board with. We're gonna bring up operating procedures as a whole to the governing board at this next meeting in 2 weeks on that Thursday. It's gonna have an outline of both TAC, the CAC, and the Vision Zero Advisory Committee, but there's no structural changes to the CAC at this point in that operating procedures.
Albert, your microphone was off, but there are no public comments on this item.
Thank you. Do any board members have any comments going left or right, starting with Mr. Fitzpatrick?
Just how are quorums figured? Does the ones that are vacancies, like there aren't currently 5 vacancies, are they factored into that?
No.
So it's, how's it work?
It's based on the seats filled. So right now, even though there's 21 board members, you do have 2 seats that were carryovers from our previous operating, our previous bylaws, which would be Greg and Terry.
Right.
So that gets you to a higher number, but we do it based on the actual seats filled and not the vacancies.
So if there's 18 seats filled, then there'll be 9 plus 1.
It's half plus 1.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fitzpatrick. Mr. Bontiglio.
Yes. Hi. Thank you. I was on Ocean Ridge Town Commission for 2 terms, and I don't recall seeing anything that you all may have sent out to them or to the town manager saying, hey, we have openings on our board. Would mm-hmm. you ask any of your citizens or recommend any of your citizens for to apply to our board? Is that something that you did in the past or haven't done in the past, or is it something you could do in the future mm-hmm. to get more members, which is to reach out to all of the various local governmental units, towns, whatever, and see if they've got citizens who are interested in serving on the board.
Yeah, that's a good question. The so the way we're structured right now for the CAC is our board members, which are the larger municipalities, all have one seat to give, right? Or one person they can elect, and they usually elect from their jurisdiction, or it has to be from their jurisdiction, I believe. And so it's really one-to-one that way, right? So we don't have, our operating procedures right now do not allow an outside member, right? That's different for the other committees now, right? So the technical advisory committee and then our Vision Zero advisory committee can actually have those jurisdictions request to the board to have a seat on those committees. And recently we just added the town of Lake Park had, I don't know if it's an engineer or planner on their staff, but they're now part of the technical advisory committee. Is that right, Margie?
Yes.
So Lake Park does not have a seat on our board, but they requested to our governing board to get a seat for the technical advisory committee, and they are approved for that. Our citizens advisory committee is not set up like that at this time.
Well, it just seems to me that kind of outreach would be good because it's reaching out to activists in whatever, you know, locality you're asking for members in. Those are the people who are going to be active in doing things, which is what you need. You need people who are going to be active in the community. So if you reach out to the various town commissions and boards and ask them, and maybe you need to change those rules to allow us to reach out to those municipalities and governmental subunits to see if there's anybody that would like to serve on this commission. Maybe that's a rule change that you might want to look at.
Mr. Brenner.
Just in follow-up to your question, I guess there are seats appointed by commission district. Is that correct? Which covers the municipalities. So there is potentially an entry point. And one of the things that would probably be helpful is for the seven county commissioners to make it clear to the municipalities within their jurisdictions that, you know, they can nominate someone or encourage someone to participate. So there's at least seven potentially where you could go to the cities that are not members and reach out to them. I was just thinking about how to make that happen. And that's that first seven may be the way to do it.
Yeah, and the people they would reach out to, it seems to me, that pool of people would be a lot more likely to want to serve than just reaching out to the general public, because believe me, being in Ocean Ridge for all the years I was, that's the people that like to serve, is the people that go to the meetings and you know, speak out and talk to the commissioner. So
thank you, Mr. Bonfiglio. Mr. Bruno, any more comments? Seeing none.
I'll close on saying that we're going to be sending our governing board members just an update, because we have a lot of turnover with those as well for new people on that committee, on that board. We're going to send everyone sort of their representatives that they've appointed to the different various committees and doing in that process, just like I guess in that process, we can just remind them that they have the opportunities to appoint ones for at least these commission districts, appoint ones from those types of municipalities. But I will also just, if I have time during this presentation or in our discussion with board members about potentially adding some other non sort of voting member or somebody outside of the governing board as an appointee as an option as well. So we'll continue that discussion for that specific point.
Thank you. No further questions. Moving on to D, Royal Palm Beach bus stop crash follow-up. Jason Price.
Sure. So for this particular item, I followed up with Palm Beach County Engineering, and they did do a crash analysis report and provided it to me, and I sent it out via email to everyone as soon as I got it. So, and then we included it as part of the backup as well. So I didn't put anything together formally to present to you. I wanted to get the report from Palm Beach County, provide it to you as soon as I got it, I included it in the backup. And then, you know, they determined that there was no engineering fix, so to speak, but the driver was heavily influenced. And that really was the catalyst for the incident, as opposed to some kind of engineering fix that they could come up with based on the location.
Makes sense. Staff, are there any public comments?
I was already ready to say no, I'm sorry, but I do have James at this time for now.
So, Mr. Montaglio.
Yes, thank you. Jason, I just wanted to thank you for following up on my request from the last commission meeting. I read through the report and it seems like most of the incidences are not a design flaw. It's just a lot of careless drivers out there. And I mean, I guess, what is that saying? Causation is not necessarily correlation, or correlation is not necessarily causation. I guess this is one of those situations where it's just got some bad drivers out in that area. But it's just a shame that they can't figure out some way to keep those accidents down. Anyway, that's my comment. But thank you again for getting that information.
Thank you. Seeing no more questions, moving on to number four, administrative items. Items 4A through 4C are informational only. There will be no staff presentation unless requested by a committee member. If none, staff, are there any public comments?
No, Mr. Chair.
Governing Board summary points, April 21st, 2022. B, FTOT scheduling report, May 2022. Public involvement activity report, March 2022. And the next meeting is June 1st of 22. Our next CAC meeting is scheduled for June 21st at this time. Our committee members is adjourned.